Welcome back to the Gray Bar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauley on King of OX.
We are back at it here on a Tuesday night, first show of the week. We had Monday Night Football last night with the Chiefs playing, so we were not on. We've got full shows this week, every night except Thursday. We'll have Thursday Night Football coming up. We're not that far out from having Billikens basketball. They're going to be getting their season here in the next month or so. So always a lot of things going on here at KMOX. Update on the baseball playoffs. It is over. Game number one of the NLDS doubleheader. The Mets beat the Phillies by a 7-2 score, and the Mets take a 2-1 series lead. Sports producer extraordinaire Kyle Sixton and I were talking about this earlier. We actually started this conversation a couple days ago, and I kind of changed my answer. He asked me what team I want to see win. And Kyle, when I first talked to you, I actually mentioned the Phillies because I'm a Bryce Harper guy. I'm a fan of Bryce Harper. I've changed kind of the team that I'm going for from a National League side of things. I enjoy the fact that every team that has ever ended the Brewers season in the playoffs has always gone on to the World Series, hasn't always won the World Series, but they have always been in the World Series, both in the American League days for the Brewers and in the National League days. Every team that has ever ended the Brewers season has gone on to the World Series, so I am now Team Mets.
That's hilarious. And the Cardinals are in there. 2011 knocked off the Brewers, went on to win it that year. So why not, right?
Yeah, so you streaks like that are cool. Like that, and it's been going on for a while. So I'm Team Mets on this one. They take the 2-1 series lead. Going to be tough for them to win this series against the Phillies, but they're closer now, up 2-1. Going to be even tougher, I think, for them to beat either the Padres or the Dodgers. That series 1-1. I think largely the St. Louis rooting contingent is rooting for the Padres because there's such affinity for Mike Schilt still in this town. So I know a lot of Cardinals fans. But then there's the Manny Machado thing. And he comes off so unlikable. So unlikable. And way too much was made of like the ball being thrown. If you would have heard Dave Roberts talk about it, you would have thought that like Machado threw a 90-mile-per-hour strike at his face. That didn't happen. He tossed the ball into the dugout, which is somewhat disrespectful, but Machado's always been that guy.
He has.
He makes a you-know-what out of himself. So there's high emotions going in that. I saw some of the video. We always see videos when the Dodgers and Giants play where fans are fighting outside. Like, that's a heated rivalry. The Dodgers-Padres has never been that kind of rivalry, but with everything going on the field, we're seeing that the delay the other day when the ball got thrown in from the stands. I mean, that thing has really heated up.
It has, and I mean, with Flaherty and Machado, like you said, Machado's already always kind of done stuff like that. That one sticks out to me with Donaldson all those years ago, where he kind of threw the bat at him almost. If you remember that when he was on the Orioles, there's just always been stuff like this with Machado, and it makes him, you don't really want to root for him, but at the same time, don't love the Dodgers either, so not really sure where to go on that one.
When I was covering the Brewers, when I was in Milwaukee, the Padres and Brewers were playing in the postseason. I think that was the NLCS year when the Dodgers beat the Brewers in seven games to get to the World Series. And Jesus Aguilar was the first baseman for Milwaukee, and Machado's just running out a ground ball, and he just spikes the living you-know-what out of Aguilar's ankle. So Aguilar's just on there on the base, ready to take, you know, it's a ground ball out, and Machado just stabs his foot into the ankle of Aguilar. Like, that's the crap that he does, and he gets somewhat of a free pass, I think, for it. At some point, something has to happen to the guy.
Yeah, and I mean, for that reason, you don't really see us rooting for him for that reason. It's just pretty unlikable, so.
The American League, the first time ever that going into today, going into game three of all the four series, first time in the history of the divisional series where all four series were tied 1-1. Today was an off day for the American League. Tomorrow is another amazing day of baseball because it's going to be four games starting. The first game is going to start at 2 o'clock. The last game is going to start at 8 o'clock. So just live for those kind of days of baseball. These American League series are interesting as well. Tigers with that Carey Carpenter home run the other day to even up the series against the Guardians. That was a fantastic moment. I've got I've got an affinity for the Royals because I spent time previously working in their organization when I was broadcasting minor league baseball. Glad that they were able to go back to Kansas City with that series at 1-1. I also think that I think there's something to learn from Kansas City. And we've talked about this a fair amount because the Royals had an offseason that when it was happening, we kept calling it like a sneaky good offseason. When they're bringing in like Michael Wacha and Seth Lugo and guys like that, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful to either of those guys. They clearly have had a huge impact on that team. But generally speaking, we can go back. Like if you do a Twitter search for the month of February, year by year, and you find the use of the term sneaky good offseason, most of those teams that you're talking about, it wasn't actually a good offseason. Like there was a couple nice players that you're bringing in the organization, but it wasn't really impactful change. So if you compare the sneaky good offseason that you thought a team had going into spring training and what the results are when you get into September, more often than not, those teams that have sneaky good offseasons, it actually wasn't that good of an offseason. There's a reason we put sneaky on it, because you can tell what's a legit good offseason and what's not. The Royals have been a little bit of the exception there. And I keep talking about this, and I'm not trying to begrudge a point. I'm really, really not. But what we can look at with the Royals, and this is why I think there's something to learn from them. Not only did they go get the Seth Lugos and the Michael Wachas, but if we're being really honest, is there really that much of a difference? And Lugo had a fantastic like first half of the season, and his numbers were really good, and he was in Cy Young Award contention for much of the year. Like I realize all of that, and I'm not trying to rewrite history. But if we really take a step back, is there really that much difference between Seth Lugo and Michael Wacha and Lance Lynn and Kyle Gibson? I would take Lugo and Wacha over Gibson and Lynn. I would, but it's not like this just gigantic difference. And Kansas City had the sneaky good offseason, and the Cardinals, those two guys did not get referred to in that kind of way. Obviously, people were happy about the Sonny Gray signing. But more so than anything else, it was as the Royals have kind of gone into a new era of what they're at right now, is their ability to build behind the scenes with adding the infrastructure that they've needed to add, adding to the analytics departments, things like that. They have given that organization the tools to allow players to best perform, and I think that's going to be a pretty good team here for a while. I'm not trying to like go all Kansas City here. We always take grief from folks because there's a contingent of people who do not like the Kansas City Chiefs because they think the Kansas City Chiefs are partially responsible for the Rams leaving St. Louis, and like the explanation for that, the reason people believe that, they voted. They were part of the voting group that allowed the Rams to leave St. Louis. So that is a valid point. I would never, ever, ever, ever be dismissive of people who feel that way. I think it's a very valid way to feel. Obviously, the Chiefs have become incredibly popular here in St. Louis, and we know that running the games on the weekend, running the game last night, there's tons of people who enjoy it. Now, the people who don't enjoy it, the people who are very anti-Kansas City and the people who are very anti-Chiefs, they are also very vocal about that. So we hear it fairly often. But that's again, don't want to spend too much time on Kansas City stuff, but I think there is something to learn from the Royals and the kind of turnaround they had from last season to this season. And then obviously the national sports story that has become the Kansas City Chiefs having a really, really good performance last night. So with all that being said, Jay Binkley works for our sister station in Kansas City. We've had him on a couple times. Wanted to talk both Royals and Chiefs with him. He's going to join us coming up in just a moment. This is the Gray Bar Sports Open Line on KMOX. It's Gray Bar Sports Open Line here on KMOX as we continue on throughout the program. Of course, we are your home for Kansas City Chiefs football here in St. Louis. And yesterday, Chiefs looked pretty darn good. There's a lot going on in Kansas City. The Royals are in the playoffs, and we're very happy to be able to bring on to the program from our sister station in Kansas City. We used to say 610 Sports. Now we say 96.5 The Fan. He is Jay Binkley. You follow him on Twitter at 3 Guys in a Garage. Jay, appreciate you taking some time with us today. How are you?
Oh, doing great, man. Doing great. Salvador Perez, I'm not out there right now, but they obviously earlier today I was watching at the press conference, you know, seeing him talking about it, just like 14 and 15. It was just, it brings back these, you know, playoff memories. You know, it's so much fun. And Kansas City will have so much fun when the fans finally are booing the other team and not the Royals, as Salvador Perez said.
Jay, you know what's fun for me in this? I spent 2 years as the broadcaster for the Kansas City Royals Low A affiliate in Burlington, Iowa. And my two years there, we got to the championship of the Midwest League each year, won it once. I had Salvi, I had Moustakas, I had Perez, I had Danny Duff, I had all those guys who were on those World Series teams. As you know, most of those guys are long gone. I saw Moustakas was throwing out first pitch at a Brewers game the other day. But, man, Salvi's still going strong, and it's been so long since I broadcast minor league baseball. I so appreciate continuing to see one of my former guys out there.
You know, he's the only one going, and that whole core group – with Hosmer, Moustakas, and Perez, and when Lorenzo came and they traded up for him and he was in the minor league, they wanted every step. They wanted A ball. They wanted double A championship. They wanted triple A championship. And a lot of the things that are going on now in the minor leagues, but the one thing that kind of makes Salvador Perez unique was, you know, he was part of that group, the young group that came up, like Hosmer and Moose, and being World Series MVP, then all the bad years for the Royals, losing 106 games last year. And then being with this young core like Bobby Witt Jr. and Vinny Pasquantino, and he's still there. Like the only player from those teams even still playing, which is crazy.
Yeah, it is. But it's fun for me. He can play as long as he wants, as far as I'm concerned. What was the level of dread when Royals fans realized that they were going to see the Yankees in the playoffs?
You know, I was excited about it. I think there's kind of a split in fans, younger fans. They may not like the Yankees because it's the big market Yankees or whatever. But then the older fans, you know, like myself, you know, remember the times. 1980, I was 7 years old when I went out there, but I did end up going to that series. And then the series won game against the Phillies. But, you know, meeting the Yankees in 76, 77, 78, and 80 just showed, I mean, this was the big rivalry for the Royals in that time period. Now, of course, it's a split now. Between the teams, and they haven't seen each other since that 1980 World Series, at least in the postseason. So, to me, it's fun. It's always those hated Yankees. I know there's a lot of people confused about the playoffs because the Tigers were the sixth seed, the Royals are the five, and they say, well, why aren't the Royals playing, or why aren't the Yankees playing the Tigers? Because normal bracketing is six would play the one. But Major League Baseball doesn't want a one seed like the Yankees having to play division winner had the Astros won. So, Right. Weird deal.
Yeah.
Weird deal.
Yeah,
they're excited about it.
It's a good win yesterday too. I mean, that was a highly contested game. Even when the Royals are up by three runs through the final few innings, it felt like every pitch, every swing matters. I know we say that about every playoff game, but that was a big win for the Royals to be able to bring it back home, even 1-1.
I mean, that was crucial, and to kind of block out of the mind what happened in the first game. You know, the play at second base, which ended up being, when Jazz Chisholm, you know, was out at second base, the replay showed him out. But the Yankees, they looked at the replay and said he was safe. That did make a huge difference in that game. Of course, the Royals didn't need to walk eight guys either. But they lost that game, and they were able to take that out of their mind and say, okay, new game, fresh start the next day. And it's a very solid team. I mean, you look at the numbers on this team compared to 2014. That 2014 team went all the way to game seven of the World Series. They swept their way all the way to the World Series. Leading RBI guy in that team was 74 with Alex Gordon. 19 home runs led that team. And two guys with over 30 stolen bases. Now this year, three guys over 30 stolen bases. You've got three guys that would have hit 100 RBI. Sal Perez did, Bobby Witt did. Vinny Pasquantino got hurt right before he could. He ended up with 97 as they were the only team in Major League Baseball. They have three guys over 70 ribs, three over 80, three over 90, then they would have had three over 100. This is just a really solid team that they've built with a lot of veteran presence, like a Tommy Pham or a Michael Wacha, you know, guys coming in this team to mix with some of the young up-and-coming guys. But it's an interesting mix of what they've been able to do is veteran and young players.
Pretty remarkable that they've been able to win the wild card series and to come back home after splitting in New York with Bobby Witt Jr. hitting just 158, only three hits through four games. If you're going to win that many games, I think most people would think that Witt's going to be right in the middle of it.
Yeah, they were. And when you think about, you know, early on that first game, the struggles between not only Perez, but Witt Jr. and Vinny Pasquantino, the guys at the bottom of the order, the ones scoring, and they were scoring more. The Baltimore series, they scored one in one game, scored two in another, and won those games. But the core wasn't hitting. The bottom of the lineup was making the crucial hits for the Royals, a lot of singles. Then, of course, this last game, Sal Perez, you know, being the captain he is, hits the home run there in Yankee Stadium. But with Witt and Pasquantino not playing like they did throughout the year, it was Bobby Witt Jr. gets on base, then he steals, then he knocks it in. It was that simple. And the good news is they've been able to win and score runs without those guys. Now, if they can get some contribution from those guys, which I'm sure they will, they'll be fine.
One of the odd things about the way the playoffs are now set up with teams playing in the wild card round is it's not one versus one in terms of pitching, and that can be bad, but it can also be good if you can split those first two games. All of a sudden, the Royals are able to come back with Lugo in game three at home. They're in a pretty good spot there.
Yeah, you're talking about a guy that put up numbers, you know, was getting Cy Young consideration this year and went to the All-Star game. And yeah, I mean, that combination of going, clearly they wanted to have Reagans go longer yesterday. But yeah, I mean, the Royals, they don't fear these pitchers. I mean, yesterday Carlos Rodon was celebrating and, you know, having fun on the mound that first inning. And all of a sudden the Royals just got all over him. I mean, he say they lock in or not, they took care of it. They were getting good hits off of Gerrit Cole. And that Yankee starting pitching didn't scare him at all.
So I went to school at K-State, so I've got tons of friends who live in Kansas City, and I can't it feels like those World Series years again. I'm seeing friends on my Facebook putting out posts. I'm going to the game. I'm parking in this section. Come on out. And so, like, the energy that exists that I'm just kind of seeing from a social media standpoint, it really, from afar, it really seems like it's just like it was in those two World Series years. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yeah, you are. In the 70s and 80s, this was a baseball town. The 90s is when this kind of transitioned into a football town. And then in 13, when they went all the way and were eliminated the final weekend, and then 14 and 15 when they go to the postseason, became a Royals town for those periods, then back to a Chiefs town. Last night, people were just excited. Mm-hmm. They were figuring out how to watch both games. They're going to Arrowhead. They're going to watch it on their phone, the Royals. A lot of people went to the Chiefs game in Royals gear. People at home were sitting there getting two TVs. You know, I had callers call in and say they went out and got another TV so they could watch Royals and the Chiefs on one. Very excited. I think it was much easier for a lot of people to watch some of the games back in 14 and 15 with the television package now. But if you want to watch them, you can buy it. It's very easy to do. But I think people are getting accustomed now to being good in both sports. It's something that hadn't happened here. The Chiefs started off 1-5 that year. The Royals won the World Series in 15, but they ended up coming back and making the playoffs, believe it or not. But not used to both teams being really good at one time. And, you know, New York, all the talk is, you know, New York, you're playing the Royals, you're the mighty Yankees and all that. Well, every NHL team in New York, every NFL team, every Major League Baseball team, every NBA team in the last decade has zero titles. Kansas City has four between football and baseball. And the lack of respect for kind of, you know, the smaller Midwest towns compared to New York. It's funny, really, when you sit back and think about it.
We're talking with Jay Binkley, part of the team at our sister station, 96.5 The Fan in Kansas City. Let's jump over to the Chiefs because they won their first four games, but you were able to find flaws in those games. Rashee Rice goes down. You're thinking, what is this team going to look like against a pretty good Saints team? And you can make the argument that was their best performance of the year last night. What did you think of what you saw from the Chiefs?
Yeah, it was their best performance, and it should have been a lot worse. I mean, just making the little mistakes that they do. I mean, they could be putting away a lot of these teams, but the red zone struggles or the turnovers, and, you know, we're seeing a lot of the same thing. Poor Patrick Mahomes will throw the football to somebody. Like Juju Smith-Schuster had a great game yesterday, no one taking away 130 yards receiving. But the key one was the one that he dropped, bounced off his hands in the end zone that became an interception for the Saints. Then the Saints went down and scored. That was a 13-point swing just in that game, even though the Chiefs were dominating that game. The defense has been lights out and fantastic. The Chiefs have limited every good running back, the number one running backs, and the number one DVOA schedule they've played to this point. They could have been winning more. The thing is, when they put everything together, what will it be? Yesterday was Andy Reid It was his best coaching performance of the year because you're right. You're without Rashee Rice. Hollywood Brown hasn't played a snap for you this year. That was going to be the big change. Chiefs are going to have that speed on the outside with Worthy on one side, Hollywood Brown on the other, Rashee Rice there working the middle of the field. But all that goes down the wayside, you know, when they get hurt or Isaiah Pacheco gets hurt and you bring in, you know, Kareem Hunt. I mean, you're talking two guys that were on their couch last month in Juju Smith-Schuster and Kareem Hunt, and they're out there winning in the NFL, getting 130 yards for Juju, over 100 for Kareem Hunt. It was impressive, and Andy Reid was running a lot of 14 personnel with the four tight ends. A lot of teams don't even keep four tight ends. Mm-hmm. Well, the Chiefs needed people to catch the football, and so they went in with a group of receivers to have Worthy and Justin Watson, who had 29 snaps, not even a target in that game, finding ways to win. Hey, I'm ready for when guys are healthy and Patrick Mahomes gets the weapons that he needs. I mean, you think about it. You put gas in the car, and I can't wait to see that. Because you go back and even look at a Peyton Manning. I mean, he had Reggie Wayne and Marvin Harrison to throw to. You know, those guys aren't walking through the door here at Arrowhead.
Do they make a move at some point to add to that receiver group, or is it just about waiting for getting some guys healthy and getting the most out of the guys they currently have the way they did last night?
You know, personally, I think if they do, it would be like an Amari Cooper type move that's owed $600,000 still, because the Chiefs are, what, 4.5 to 4.7 under the cap. Not much. They don't have much money to spend. Like, they don't have that big money to bring in a lot of receivers. And one thing they've been able to do is win with less, and they have to keep doing it. They rely on their quarterback, you know, that offense to get the job done. And then, of course, this defense, the way they're playing, well, they need that. If they have more of a reliance on the running game now and playing good defense, the splashy receiver, I think they'll make a move. I definitely think they're going to make a move. But this offense is so complex. So to think someone could come right in here and do it, it's more difficult than it seems. It's like last year when they made that move for Hardman because he knew the offense already. He'd already won with the Chiefs. They bring back Juju because Juju knew the offense and won a ring with the Chiefs. So, yes, I think they make a move, but it's very difficult just to be thrown right in the situation and have that chemistry with Patrick Mahomes.
Jay Binkley, part of the team at 96.5 The Fan in Kansas City, our sister station, hosting Chiefs post game and doing much, much more. Jay, enjoy this great time of Kansas City sports, and hopefully we can catch up again real soon.
Yeah, having a lot of fun, my friend. My friend, just give me a call anytime you want to.
Jay Binkley joining us here on the program. We appreciate him spending a few moments with us talking through the cool things going on with the Royals and obviously the Chiefs as well. Speaking of cool things, the Blues get a win today. We'll hear a little from head coach Drew Bannister after they get a come-from-behind victory in Seattle. That's up next. This is a Graybar Sports Open Line on KMOX. Back at it on a Graybar Sports Open Line right here on KMOX. My name is Matt Pauly. So the Blues win earlier today. They open up their season with a victory. You know, we don't talk about hockey, obviously, in halves because it's periods, but it really was a game of two halves. When you look at the first period and the first half of the second period, the Blues were one team. They were down 2-0. They were getting outshot. They were not playing strong defense. They weren't doing any of these things. And then all of a sudden things turned and they end up scoring three goals in a very short amount of time, and they end up winning by a 3-2 score. Wanted to play for you some of the reaction from Blues head coach Drew Bannister. And the first thing he really talked about was how everything did just flip. I mean, they were they gave up 11 shots in the first period. Early on in the second period, the shot differential was even more pronounced on the side of Seattle, and then they just were able to turn it on. And Bannister, when speaking to the media, did go through some of the things that happened that led to the turnaround.
The first, you know, half of the game, we seemed hesitant. We weren't playing on our toes. There wasn't a lot of communication on the ice between line mates, between D partners. We just seemed to be chasing the game a little bit too much. But, you know, to be honest with you, just the life on the bench was continued to be there, and just like guys pushing each other to get things going. And, you know, overturn goal, a little bit of a scrum, you know, we get to a power play, you know, we score right away off it. And then the next shift after that, it was like just a switch turn for us. We started forward checking. We were aggressive. Our D were down on pucks. Our forwards were reloading and backing up. And just seemed, you know, from the second half on, we kind of took over, you know, took control of the game.
Yeah, so he talks about it in terms of halves as well. And the way this thing went down, again, they're down 2-0 and they scored the three goals in about 3 minutes. And Jordan Kyrou ended up scoring two of those goals. Now, he mentioned the scrum. There was a disallowed goal, and then the two teams got after each other a little bit after that. And Bannister talked about maybe the energy that was brought as a result of that scrum.
I think sometimes, like, a little bit of pushback is good. And I think at that point, we needed a little bit more energy to our game. And, you know, Wox, Torpo, Fax, like, those guys, you know, there's a lot of guys that brought a lot of energy to the game once we started really getting going. But, you know, for whatever reason, it kind of jump-started us a little bit. But certainly the power play goal really brought life to our bench.
I said this earlier, and I'm going to repeat it, and you're going to hear me repeat it over and over and over and over again. I think there's two really big keys for the Blues this year if they want to have a level of success where they are a legitimate playoff contender. I think Jordan Kyrou has to be close to a 40-goal scorer, and I think defensively they need to be they have to play above their heads defensively. When you look at who they have on the roster, they have to play better defensively than what you would think that they would be. So they've got to outperform a little bit from a defensive standpoint. If they do, if those two things happen, I think the people who are excited and high on this Blues team, that's kind of the equation that leads to them being better than maybe they look like they should be on paper. So Jordan Kyrou scores the two goals. One's a power play goal. The other goal is the one that gives the team the 3-2 lead. That ends up being the final score. So last year, Kyrou leads the team 31 goals. But it was kind of a slow start for him. He did get his first goal in the second game, but then it took another 8 games for him to get his second. So he is where he's at right now with 2 goals, is essentially where he was at 10 games into the season last year. And Bannister did talk about Kyrou and what he saw from him today.
You know, took advantage of his opportunities. There was a couple of more opportunities where I'd like to see him, you know, really bear down. But he's finding areas. Guys were finding him. Again, he's using his speed. He's competing. And, you know, good things happen when he's doing that.
Look, we're going to be doing a lot of comparing from last year to this year, and certainly one of the things that let the Blues down at time was their ability to score with the man advantage. Well, they score a power play goal today. That was good. Their first goal does come on the power play, and Bannister talked a little bit about the importance of not just scoring power play goals, but scoring them early on in the season and trying to gain some traction with the man advantage.
I think just early in the year, just for confidence, like I think it goes a long way with our group. You know, I like the way they moved the puck. I thought there were some chances even on their second time when we came out in the third period where, you know, they had some pretty good looks and we just missed. But, you know, I still believe, like, our group was going to keep pushing. Like, at some point it was going to turn for us, you know, whether it was power play or walks. I just felt, you know, at that time, you could feel the confidence on our bench. Like, we were ready to kind of turn the page and get back to work.
You know, earlier I talked about my keys for the season being defense and Jordan Kyrou. I didn't mention Jordan Binnington because I'm at a point right now with Binnington where I just think he's just a legit really good goalie and you can count on him. Like, I count on that from Binnington. I think he's going to be able to, he's going to keep you in games, and he's certainly going to go out and win you some games. So obviously good goaltending is a key to the equation for the Blues having success as well. So Binnington, with the Blues just completely being outshot in the first period, the Blues in Seattle were able to skate to a 0-0 tie after one period. Now, Binnington does give up the two early goals early on the second period, but I mean, he was just being peppered shot after shot after shot. It wasn't fair. And then all of a sudden, the Blues take that lead, and he really locked in after that. So he faces 32 shots. He makes 30 saves. You'll take that. That was a good day for Binnington, and his coach obviously was pleased with the performance.
It's like you can have a long conversation and not bring up his name, but he's the reason.
Yeah, Binner was outstanding early on when we weren't at our best, you know, and we saw that a lot last year, and we had to rely on him early to keep that game close, and I thought he did that well for us. You know, and again, then the guys rallied for him, and we found a way to win a hockey game for him.
And then the final thing from Bannister speaking just a few moments ago in Seattle. Defensively, things changed. The Blues were not good defensively, again, for that first half of the game, for the first period and the first half of the second period, and then things flipped. And maybe they flipped because they felt the energy from the goal scoring, but they were really good defensively, especially in the third period as well. The Blues on the road in a pretty good environment there in Seattle, opening up the season, they played an entire third period with a one-goal lead, and they were able to protect that lead without adding on, and they get the 3-2 victory. And even though it was a rough start defensively for the Blues, Bannister was obviously very happy with what he saw, especially in the third period from his defensive groups.
I think just the whole third period, we were really good. You know, I mean, the shots that they got were probably in the power play, but, you know, after that, there was limited chances. You know, I thought we supported the puck well. We were, you know, pretty good on the walls. Our D got back to pucks, but we forced them to play from their goal line back. You know, we were able to get in a forecheck, and we created some good offensive opportunities where their goalie had to make some pretty difficult saves.
So that's Drew Bannister speaking after the Blues getting the win in Seattle. Again, that's a... that's a good victory. That's a really good victory for this team. And good to see them pick up the win, and hopefully they're able to take some momentum throughout the rest of this trip. Tough start to the season, really tough start to the season for them as they play three straight games on the road out west. They will travel. They're probably traveling right now to San Jose. They'll spend the day there tomorrow, play their Thursday night, and then they're doing the back-to-back. They're playing the three games in 4 days, West Coast, after they play in San Jose on Thursday night. They'll make the quick trip over to Vegas, and they'll match up against the Golden Knights on Friday night. They'll get back into St. Louis late Friday, and then they'll have the weekend until they open up the home portion of their schedule, and they're going to play four straight home games. They'll welcome in Minnesota on Tuesday, then they'll play the Islanders, Carolina, and Winnipeg all on this homestand. I was listening to somebody talk about this recently. I think it was somebody that was on the Dave Glover show. They were talking about people visiting St. Louis, and I think the conversation was based around the impact of the Cardinals, because if you live in Arkansas, or if you live in Tennessee, or if you live in Oklahoma, you can come into St. Louis for a weekend, or you can come into St. Louis for a week. You can catch multiple Cardinals games in addition to doing other things. And the point that was made was the Blues schedule largely kind of presents in the same way. There's a lot of extended homestands. So they'll play, what, the four straight home games coming up. They've got another stretch from November 2nd to November 12th where they're going to play five straight home games. They'll have another stretch coming up later. So there's a handful of times in January. They'll play four straight home games from January 9th to January 16th. Not to make this, and I mean, I could go through the entire schedule. There's many more situations like that as the year goes along. But as somebody that wants people to visit St. Louis and have a reason to come in, and just sports very much being the front door to our city sometimes, if the schedule can work out where the Blues can have multiple home games in a week or so, and folks can come in and enjoy a game or two and also do a few other things, I think I prefer that style of scheduling. You don't always get that in the NHL, but 3-4, sometimes 5-game homestands, even if it results in going on the road for 3-4-5 games at a time, I think there is some value to extended homestands. Now, on the other side of it, you're on the road for a long time. That wears on you, especially these, like this West Coast trip, maybe not because it's the first trip of the year, but when you're playing three games in 4 days, so you've got a back-to-back in there and they're on the road, that's always a pretty solid challenge. All right, one more break. We'll come back and we will wrap up this edition of the program. It's a Graybar Sports Open Line, and we're back with more on KMOX.
Welcome back to the Graybar Sports Open Line. Once again, Matt Pauly on KMOX.
Just a couple minutes left in the program. At your service with Dave Simons on the way after the 8 o'clock news. You certainly won't want to miss that. This just came down over the last hour or so. I'm going to try to spend some more time on this tomorrow. Those of you who listen to me on an everyday basis, you know that when it comes to college athletics and the changing dynamic of all things in college athletics is something I enjoy talking about, I'm passionate about. The NCAA Division I Council announcing today that they have voted to shorten the transfer portal window for FBS football, FCS football, men's and women's basketball. So the total number of days that players in FBS and FCS football can enter the transfer portal will go from 45 days to 30 days. But they have preserved the spring transfer window. There was some talk about closing the spring transfer window. They are going to move forward with a 20-day window from December 9th, the Monday after the conference championship game, through December 28th, and then a 10-day spring window that's going to take place in April. The basketball thing is what I'm more concerned about. And honestly, it's because of things like teams opting out of the NIT because players are going to be transferring out, or because coaches feel like they got to go work the transfer portal and they don't have time to coach their team in the NIT. It's ridiculous. It's wrong. It's some of the worst aspects of college athletics. I know these kids are getting paid money now with NIL. I'm not trying to be, I don't know, have a utopian thought on this. I get it. Like it is a business, but it is still college athletics. It is still 18 to 22-year-olds maybe playing the final college athletics games of their lives, and they're not going to get a chance to play in the NIT because their coach wants to go work the transfer portal? Like, I hate that. I can't tell you how much I hate that. So they've pushed back the opening of the transfer portal in basketball until after the end of the second round of the NCAA tournament. I'm not sure if that's going to fix this problem with teams opting out of the NIT and things like that, but it won't hurt. And maybe it's a good step forward. Again, we're going to talk about this a fair amount tomorrow because I've got thoughts, and I think it's very, very, very important when it comes to college athletics. Certainly appreciate you being tuned into the program today. Thanks to all of my guests as well. Dave Simon's up next with At Your Service. I'm back with you tomorrow at 6 o'clock here on KMOX.